The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled The Legacy of the Gaonim, Their Major Works and Contributions, is dedicated to the memory and le'ilui nishmas Rav Avrohom ben Rav Tzvi Hirsch, Olav HaSholom, Rabbi Avrohom Gardin, of blessed memory. The history of human civilization is full of peaks and valleys. Islamic civilization, the detailed subject of previous lectures, arose in the 7th century, reached its zenith in the 9th and 10th centuries, and then suffered a steep and irreversible decline. Christian civilization reached some of its greatest heights in the 4th and 5th centuries with some of its most brilliant thinkers. That period of church history was also partially covered in a previous lecture. After this golden age, however, Christian civilization witnessed a period of relative inactivity for some 700 years, called commonly the Dark Ages. The history of Jewish civilization, however, has had no Dark Ages or declines. Our history is one full of literacy and literary contributions from the time of the giving of the Torah to the present day. The period of the Gaonim, the period covered in this year's series, roughly corresponds to the Dark Ages of the Christian world. In this period of Jewish history, rabbinic scholars not only faithfully preserved their past, but also created classical and seminal works of responsa literature, history, liturgy, halacha, and much more. A review of many of the major works of that period is the subject of tonight's lecture. The creation of the Siddur, a work that took much of its present form in the Gaonic period, will be the subject of the next lecture. The term Gaon is a title of honor which is the equivalent of the title of His Excellency or His Highness. The plural of Gaon is Gaonim. In the strictest sense, this was the title that was given to the Rosh Yeshivas, the heads of the yeshivas of Pumbedisa and Sura in Bavel, Babylon, today's Iraq, during the period that began in the year 589, when Rav Chonon of Ishkaya became the head of the yeshiva of Pumbedisa, and ended with the death of Rav Haigoin of Pumbedisa in the year 1038, a period that lasted almost 450 years. In that period, the Babylonian yeshivas, headed by their Rosh Yeshivas, the Gaonim, played the leading role in scholarship and religious guidance for the entire Jewish world, from Spain and France to North Africa and Egypt to Persia and beyond. The yeshivas of Babylon, in fact, were themselves called Gaon Yaakov. That was the name of the yeshiva. You know, the yeshiva like Eitz Chaim, or, you know, the yeshiva this name or that name. The official name of the Babylonian yeshivas was Gaon Yaakov. And in letters and correspondence, when they would refer to the Gaon, they wouldn't refer to him as Gaon. So the Rosh Yeshivas, Gaon Yaakov, the head of the yeshiva of Gaon, the splendor, the eminence of Jacob. It seems over time, when they referred to the head of the yeshiva, they just skipped the other names and just called him Gaon. We referred previously, in a previous lecture, to the Meiri, who claims that the gematria, the numerical equivalence of the word Gaon, is 60, which corresponds roughly to the number of tractates that the leader of the yeshiva had to know by heart in order to get the position, to be fit for the position of the head of the yeshiva, because he had to know the entire Talmud by heart. So even though the name Gaon in the strict sense refers again to the Rosh Yeshiva's Gaon Yaakov, the head of the yeshiva, in the broader sense, though, there were famous scholars of that period, such as Rav Acha of Shavcha, the author of the Shieldus, which we'll cover in this lecture, and Rav Nissim ben Yaakov, head of the yeshiva of Keruan in North Africa. They didn't actually head a Babylonian yeshiva, but nonetheless, they were given the honorific title of Gaon. Rav Achoy, or Rav Acha, was called Rav Achoy Goyim. And Rav Nissim, who was a contemporary of Rav Hai Gaon, is called Rav Nissim Gaon, even though in a technical sense they did not actually head the yeshivas of Babylon and technically were not truly Gaonim. In addition, the heads of the yeshiva in Babylon retained the title Gaon even after the year 1038, the death. This is the year that marks the death of Rav Hai Gaon, the last of the Gaonim in Babylon. But even after that year, the heads of the yeshivas, and they played, of course, no longer a central role, which was a minor role, still retained this honorific title, Gaon. But when we are going to refer to Gaonim in this lecture, we are referring, in the strict sense, to the yeshivas in Absurim Pumpadisa, in Babylon during this period, this 450-year period. In dealing with the literature of the period, I would like to begin with the responsa. Because more than any form of literature, the Gaonim specifically are associated with teshuvas, with the responsa. Similar to questions that are posed to our Supreme Court, unresolved questions of law that are given throughout the country for a final decision, so too the greatest scholars from across the world send their unresolved questions to the yeshivas in Babylon. Before the year 760, approximately the period of Rabbi Yehudoi Gaon, very few responsa have been preserved. After that time, however, up until the end of the life of Rav Hai Gaon in the year 1038, there exists today a wealth of literature that sheds light on virtually every aspect of halacha and was used as a basis for the rulings of later authorities. Unfortunately, only a relatively small amount of the original responsa literature of the Gaonim has been preserved. Those responsa that have been preserved are found in three primary sources. First, there's the early halachic post-Gaonic works, which liberally quote these responsa, especially those works that are composed in the 12th and 13th centuries. The Sefer Itim, written by Rabbi Yehuda of Barcelona of Spain. Sefer Eshkol, written by Avraham Av Beis Din, known as the second Rivet, this is in Provence, and the Shibole Leket, written by Rav Tzidkia HaRofe in Italy. So that's the first source. In other words, if we look at there are many halachic works, post-Gaonic halachic works, some written some 200-300 years later, we will find they have preserved many of these responsa. They are a great source. Secondly, there are private collections of Gaonic responsa, which were preserved in manuscript form throughout Europe. For the most part, they were eventually published by the end of the 19th century, as they were in various libraries and collections. These collections, some of the more famous, are called Shari Tzedek, Shari Teshuva. There's a Teshuva Sagonim, which was published by Reb Harkavi. These collections contain thousands of responsa. Of course, in all probability, the Gaonim wrote tens of thousands of responsa. A relatively new and very rich source of responsa literature has been the Cairo Geniza. In the attic of the Ben Ezra Synagogue in Fustat, which is old Cairo in Egypt, there was a Geniza, an archive, a literal treasure trove of over 100,000 manuscripts, dating back over 1,000 years. Generally, what a geniza is that when old manuscripts are no longer in use because of wear and tear or whatever, and not to be thrown out, they're given an honored place. And in the very dry atmosphere, you know, of Egypt, these manuscripts, which were placed in boxes, had very little, after their initial use, had relatively very little decomposition. I mean, that which would, if we would have placed something in Detroit in a box, there wouldn't be much left after 100 years. But this was kept. Some of these manuscripts are 1,000 years old, and yet they were beautifully kept. I mean, I guess there's a little wear, and again, some of them were just as when they were put originally in, because of use, you only got part of a manuscript. You know, it's Seamus. They said that's what it was. Many scholars have devoted their lives deciphering and interpreting these manuscripts, or probably more accurately, fragments of manuscripts, because most of them have not been preserved in their whole state. Besides being a tremendous source of early medieval religious poetry, there are many piyutim and collections of piyutim, religious poetry, which are found nowhere else in the world except in this geniza. There is Karayit and rabbinic literature and history. Much of their compositions that normally would not have been preserved of the Karoyim, of these Karaites, which was a topic of a previous lecture, have been preserved in this geniza, as well as much the rabbinic polemics on the other side in their defense. These were virtually unknown before their discovery. The geniza also contain a wealth of responsa literature that has opened for us a new business of understanding. In this series, whenever we quote from the geniza or the various other collections, we will point it out as what our sources are. Now, during this whole period of 450 years, there were other places of higher Jewish learning. Italy probably ranks number one, followed by Israel. Towards the end of the Gaonic period, Cairo, what is today Tunisia, Egypt, Spain were major centers. So we have to ask ourselves the question, so why did the Gaonim and their yeshivas enjoy such an immense and long-lasting influence, despite the fact that since they were competitive places of learning? And there seems to be two principal reasons. Number one, although there were other centers of Torah scholarship, as we pointed out, because of Babylon's fame and its traditions, the Babylonian yeshivas were always able to attract the largest numbers of the brightest and best that the Jewish people produced. For those that are familiar, it's something akin to the Lakewood Yeshiva in America. Now, there are other yeshivas, but there's no yeshiva in America that has 2,000 young scholars, and 1,500 of them are married. To give you some idea of what was like in the yeshivas of Babylon, I'd like to quote you the eyewitness report of Reb Sachya of Regensburg. Reb Sachya lived was about 150 years after the close of the Gaonic era, when Babylon was already in decline. So this account is taken from probably the year 1180. That was 1038 is when the last of the Gaonim died, Rav Hai Gaon. This is 140 years or so later. He visited many Jewish communities throughout the world and produced an invaluable account of his travels. This is what he had to say about Baghdad, which at that time was the Torah center in Iraq, in Babylon. And again, this is after the decline of scholarship. First, he pointed out that in Baghdad, all the Jews walked around with woolen talisim and tzitzis. He spoke about the Rosh Yeshiva, who was given the title Gaon, the Shmuel Halevi ben Ali, and he quotes, "He is a prince full of wisdom of both the written and oral Torah, all the wisdom of Egypt, and nothing is hidden from him. He knows Shemos," these are the names of Kabbalistic names to use for healing or whatever, "and he knows the entire Talmud." He's evidently very impressed with him. He continues on, I quote, "Among the people of the land there is no ignoramus who would not know all 24 books of the Bible. The vocalization is how to pronounce every word. And he knows diktuk, they know the Hebrew language. In reading, they know what's chaser and yeser, in other words, what words should be pronounced, you know, which are extra with the vav or without the vav. The chazan, as this is common amongst Sfardim, does not read for them, as in Ashkenazic communities. There's no bal kore, but everyone is called up and reads on their own. At the head of the yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva has some 2,000 students. 500 or more sit around him, I guess these are the closest students. All understand well, and until they know, until they're able to be close to him, I guess of the elite group of 500, they study in the city with other scholars. And when they're able to, you know, to reach that level, then they go to the Rosh Yeshiva. And he goes on to the pomp of the yeshiva. There was, we've discussed in previous lectures about the Reish Galusa, was the exilarch, the descendant of the house of David. Well, they had one who was still there. Of course, his power was much diminished, and he is under the head of the yeshiva. The head of the yeshiva has a big house covered with awnings, is dressed in golden clothes, and he sits above, and the students sit on the floor. And he speaks to the interpreter, and the interpreter speaks to the students. And the students ask their questions from the interpreter, in other words, they don't ask directly. And if he does not know the answer, he asks of the head of the yeshiva. And one interpreter on one side says one tractate of the Talmud, another interpreter on the other side says another tractate. Exactly how this is, maybe different, again, there are different groups that are studying. And the whole Talmud is studied in cantillation. Evidently, they studied it by heart. It was a sing-song. This is how they studied. This is 150 years after the period of the Gaonim. So we have a sense of what it was like. You can imagine this afterwards, what it was like in the heyday of the Gaonim. As we explained in the previous lecture, the yeshivas of Surim from Padisa were not merely schools of higher learning, but they were also, as was that yeshiva, of course, that we've just described, were also the place of a semi-annual conclave of the greatest scholars of Babylon. This is the Yarchei Kala, the months of Kala. They took place in the Hebrew months of Adar and Elul. It was at these conclaves of the response that were created. In other words, the response were not the works of the individual Gaonim, but represented the collective opinion of the entire scholarly body. That's why they were taken so seriously and had such impact. And they have on the handouts, the first quote is from Nosson HaBavli, you see in the bold type at the end. This is an eyewitness account. This Nosson HaBavli, it seems, was an eyewitness who lived in the 10th century of events that occurred to the Gaonim and the Reish Galusa. He speaks, we're going to quote him in further lectures. It's an invaluable historical source. There's a question of historians, is it an original work? Perhaps the initial work was written in the 10th century, but it was added to afterwards. As you notice here on the first page, and we've read through in the previous lecture, we've gone through this particular quote. Every day of the month of Adar, the Rosh Yeshiva would bring out to them all of the questions that had reached him, and he would give the yeshiva permission to respond. In other words, so what do you say? And they would first honor him and say, we're not going to say anything, you know. It's in your presence. We'll not respond in your presence. Only when he would prevail upon them, this was the protocol, they would respond, each according to his understanding and wisdom. They would ask and answer, argue back and forth, look very deeply into every matter. The Rosh Yeshiva would listen to their words and would discern all they said, and which they asked each other. Then he would get up and think through the words until he was certain he had uncovered the truth. It was only after that process that he would go and tell the scribe to write the response. He told the scribe what to write. The scribe wrote the responsa. This was done every day until all the questions that had come throughout the year would be answered. There's a question among scholars, is actually it only happened 1 month of the year, or did it happen perhaps other times as well? Because we do have response, at least from some of the Gaonim, that are dated other times of the year. Perhaps this was the case at the time he gave testimony. And in other periods it could be different. This is how the responsa were written. And after it was all done, he would affix his signature to this. To give you a sense of what a responsa looked like, here we quote one of the responsa. Generally in these collections, all we have is the final legal decision. Very few of the responsa have whole titles to them. This is an exception. And you hear this from Amram Bar Sheshna, Resh Masift of Mosa Machasir. This was in the middle of the 9th century. To all the rabbis and their disciples and the rest of our brethren of the House of Israel dwell in Barcelona. And it's a very formal document. You receive greetings from me, from Martsemach, the judge, and there's the dayan of the yeshiva. The head of the assemblages, the Reish Kala, these were the minor leaders, there were 7 of them. And from all the scholars that are ordained, who are in place of the great Sanhedrin, they had a place, there were 70 scholars who sat right in front of the Rosh Yeshiva. And they called themselves the great Sanhedrin, because the original Sanhedrin had 70 members. And from the establishment in place of the minor Sanhedrin, because there were other scholars behind who were called the minor Sanhedrin, as a drop below. And then from all the other scholars and Tanoim, these are the experts of the extra Talmudic literature, the extra Brises, who constantly require of your well-being, as it's a very nice formal letter, like we are sending you, and here now this is our response. So you get the sense of everyone is there together and they are responding together. So first, as we've explained, the Gaonim and their yeshivas had a preeminent position because of the numbers. This is the conclave of all these scholars. But there was another reason it had such a special place. And that was because of their ability to preserve the traditions of the scholarship that existed from the end of the Talmudic period all the way to their time. And here we quote, here on page 2, in section 2, from various responsa, we have from Beshrur Gaon and Rav Hai Gaon, that describe how well that they have preserved the literature of the previous generations. They had commentaries, which are not in print, but they had commentaries that were preserved orally from the Rabbonim Savaroi. These were the rabbis who were right after the period of the Talmud, right before the period of the Gaonim. They were the ones who left their final imprint on the Talmud. And they had those, they were privy to those traditions. Not the yeshivas of Italy or Israel or Spain could lay claim to such a treasure of knowledge. And again, referring to even the collections of the responsa that were made throughout all the generations. We have one of the responsa of Hai Gaon. This is paragraph B. As for you, our colleagues, guard the words from our mouths, for they come from reliable tradition, which is handed down to us verbatim from our fathers and the fathers of our fathers for many generations. And finally, here on top of page 3, in a responsa from Rav Shur Gaon, again he describes how he we are very clear what has occurred in the days of our Paltoi Gaon, because they had clear records of things that occurred 150 years before them. Rav Paltoi Gaon says Rav Acha says Amar Rav Acha, Rav says Matatzia Gaon, and we have it with the same clarity as if it happened yesterday. So again, a second reason is why it had a preeminent position, because they preserved traditions. Not only did these responsa answer specific questions, but they're really a source of entire commentaries. There's a commentary on many tractates we have from Rav Haigon, which are evidently written as responsa and are preserved, at least much of it is preserved. There is a on page 3, section 3, paragraph A, there is a letter which was found in the Cairo Geniza, which was sent from one of the leaders of the yeshiva of Pumpadisa, the center of Chizdoy ben Shafrut, which we're going to discuss in a subsequent letter, the leader of Spanish Jewry. And it was telling about the close connections that the yeshivas of Babylon always had with Spain. And he says, in the days of our master and teacher of Paltoy, Rosh Yeshiva, as we had before, he was from 841 to 857, did the community of Spain send him or request him a copy of the Talmud with commentary? And Paltoy says, acceded to their request and commanded it be written to them, and there was actually a whole, not only the Talmud, but a commentary to the Talmud was sent to them. We have here on the bottom here, page 3, this again, this Psachia of Regensburg that we've quoted previously, states, in the land of Bavel they study the commentaries of Rav Sadia made on scriptures and on the six orders, which could mean in the Talmud of the Mishnah. So they not only compose answers to specific questions, they compose whole commentaries. Rashi uses it as a source no less than 34 times about his commentary on the Talmud. Was looking for a word or an understanding. In the response of the Gaonim, they explain this passage like this or that passage like that. The next area I'd like to touch upon. So we've discussed the response of the Gaonim. The Gaonim themselves, the superior position it had amongst all the other Torah centers, and because of its numbers, number of the great scholars, the ability to, they preserve the traditions of hundreds and hundreds of years, their output specifically down to specific halakha questions, and their commentaries on the Talmud itself. But during this period, we find sources which illuminate the history of the Jewish people in a way that if without it, we would have no other source. The first is something which we've quoted before. It's called Seder Olam Zuta. It's on page 4. This Seder Olam, which ends this, there's a famous work called Seder Olam, which was composed, it seems, by the Tana, the disciple of Rabbi Kiva, Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta. That's the famous Seder Olam. This Seder Olam means order of the world. This is Seder Olam Zuta. Zuta means minor in Aramaic. This is the minor order of the world. And in it, it preserves the names of all the descendants of King David, who were the leaders of Babylonian Jewry, the Resh Galusa. And here we have, if you on page 5, translated in English, it starts off, and as I've just preserved here the salient points here. It starts off, you know, the generations from Adam to the flood. But the following is the genealogy of the Rosh Gol in Babylon. It starts from King David, of course, which is a genealogy we're all familiar with. But then it goes on to give names of people we wouldn't know existed had not this source been around. In the middle of this, of course, is the story which was the subject of a previous lecture, of how one of the it seems that during the time of the Rabbonin Savaroy, the post-Talmudic period, the Resh Galusa were very violent people. I mean, this is the story how he this Resh Galusa, Mar Zutra, was a son-in-law of the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Hanina, how he tortured him. And because of the Rosh Yeshiva's cries, as the whole family was killed out, and you could read it inside, there was a child that was left in utero. There was a grandsons of Rav Hanina's, the whole family died out. His daughter was preserved. The child was born, and this child was called, says Mar Zutra. The Rav Huna was the previous Reish Galusa. His son was Mar Zutra. He eventually led a revolt against the Persians, which was unsuccessful. He was put to death. The Rosh Yeshiva at the time was put to death. Terrible disruptions, and as Rav Isaac Halevi points, as parallels to what seems to be terrible disruptions that are alluded to in the history of Rav Shrira Gaon, which we're going to speak of in a moment. Later on, though, there was a remaining son that was born the day that his father was put to death. He was the only heir to the throne, so to speak, of being the Reish Galusa. He eventually escaped to Eretz Yisrael, and it goes on to list another 10 generations of this second Mar Zutra, as you see on page 6. You know, from number 34 all the way, it says, to 43. And according to this version, of there are various versions, but of this Seder Olam Zuta, there were 43 Rosh Gola from Yochan, the king of Yehuda, until this last one, which puts us approximately in the year 750-800. It seems that the author of this work did not recognize the legitimacy of those who claimed to be the Reish Galusa, the exilarch, who still remained in Babylon. This Mar Zutra left, had children in Israel, and it keeps on describing the children he had in Israel. There's no description of those members, distant relatives of his perhaps, who again became the heads, the Reish Galusa, the heads of Babylonian Jewry, of whom Bustanoi is the most famous, and who went on to create a whole very powerful house of David in Babylon. And it's been suggested the reason that the author of this work did not mention them is, as we've stated before in a previous lecture, there is a question about the legitimacy of the children of Bustanoi because he married a slave woman. And it was a question of if she converted, and then if she did not convert, the children were not truly considered al pi halacha descendants of the house of David. They're Jews, you know, because they eventually married Jews in any case, and the children are Jewish. They're eventually freed because there was a cloud over them. Are they truly children of a slave woman? And they're really slaves, and one of the Rosh Yeshivas mandated that they be freed in any case. But there was a cloud over the fact is, did this woman convert to Judaism, or was she still a slave woman, and therefore the children were not truly considered descendants of the house of David. And because of that cloud, the author of this work did not even mention them. That's the theory why it's so. But again, this Seder Olam Zuta is an invaluable historical source. The second source here is the Seder Tanoim V'Amoroim. This source ends in the year 886. The other one ended at 750-800. This one ends in the year 886. And it's an invaluable source for two reasons. First of all, in a sense, it gives us history that we didn't know. For instance, and this we've quoted from a previous lecture, and we find this quote in a response from Hai Gaon, written many years later as well. From the days of Moshe, on page 6 in the bottom, until Hillel, there were 600 orders of Mishnah. The Mishnah that we have has 6 orders. The original was much, much larger. It had 600 orders. But it continues on from the time of Hillel on. The world became impoverished, the glory and power of Torah became diminished, and Hillel and Shammah instituted a mere six orders. They created a mini Mishnah, so to speak. And that is the Mishnah that we have today. The Talmud in Chagiga Yudalad Amud Aleph does refer to people who knew the original 600 orders of Mishnah. But it's interesting that this is the source that says it dates back all the way from Moshe. It also has dates of the deaths of various scholars that are then we wouldn't know the chronology had we not had this document. Secondly, this document is a source for guidelines of how to rule in halacha. There's many of the as we're going to see that the top of page 7, this is in the second line, until Rava, the halacha is not in accordance with the opinion of the student when arguing against his master. We have if Rav Huna, who's a student of Rav, would argue with Rav, we would inevitably rule like Rav, the master. After Rava, it changes. From that time on, we say halacha kebasroi, the halacha is like the latter authority. The wise goes beyond the province of this lecture, but this is a major tool that is used universally in figuring out, reading through the Talmud and figuring out what should I actually do. This is the source. Also, historically, as if he's in the bottom page 6, this is every Stam, unidentified Rabbi Yehuda at the very end. So up to page 7 is Rabbi Yehuda Bar Eloi. This is if you say Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah, we know it's Rabbi Yehuda Bar Eloi. Every Stam, unidentified Rabbi Shimon is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. It's really a guideline of how to interpret the Talmud. Again, this is an invaluable source, and it was recognized as such by later authorities. Tosfos here on page 7, I'm not going to quote all of it, but liberally quotes from the Seder Tanoim Vamaroyim. And quotes rulings from it. So again, we have the second source. So first is the Seder Olam Zuta, and second is the Seder Tanoim Vamaroyim. We've already mentioned this is why it wasn't included in this section was the account of Nosson HaBavli. It's not a sweeping history like the others. But actually, it's a major source because here we have an eyewitness report of what happened in the day-to-day life of the Gaonim. It describes in detail the coronation of the Reish Galusa, how Reish Galusa was crowned. It's a very interesting ceremony, which we've alluded to before. The crowning of the Gaon, the Rosh Hashivas, the installation. It's a very ornate, or this is a formal ceremony. This again, he seems to have been an eyewitness. The description that we had before of how the tshuvas, how the responsa were composed, or how the yeshivas looked like, Rav Nosson HaBavli is our source. Finally, this is the letter of Rav Shriragon. Rav Shriragon was asked by the community of Keruan, this is in North Africa in today's Tunisia, from the whole community, led by Rav Yaakov ben Nissim, who was the father of, we quoted before, Rav Nissim ben Yaakov. Rav Nissim was the title of Nissim Gaon, the head of the community in North Africa. And they asked various questions. How was the Mishnah written? And there's a question what he responded, actually, because it seems in many editions he says the Mishnah was not written until much, much later. It was composed, in other words, really it comes from previous works, and it was edited. Basically, it was all oral. But there are editions that claim that it was additionally written. What is the order of the tractates? How was the Talmud written? The order of the Rabbonin and Savaroi, in other words, the rabbis who followed the Talmud. And who reigned after the Rabbonin Savaroi, which he gives as a list of all the Gaonim in much of their history. And all of this is contained in his letter. It is a major source in understanding both Talmudic history and the history of the Rabbanan Savaroi, the post-Talmudic history, and the Gaonim. And again, in past lectures, and we will continue to quote from it quite liberally. So again, we have, again, these three or four invaluable historical sources that were composed only in the time of the Gaonim. Which takes us now, we said, to section 5. It's quite ironic that the most popular works of the period of the Gaonim, the halachic works, that were most widely used in subsequent generations, were not written by the Gaonim themselves, but rather other leading Babylonian scholars. And these two works are the She'iltas and the Halachos Gedolos. So let me explain. The She'iltas, as we're going to see, is really it was an artistic work, so to speak, where you find the scholar, and this is Rav Acha of Shavcha, who's responding to these questions, mixing in agadata, mixing in the moral and ethical and philosophical sections of the Talmud together with the halachic sections. So an answer to a question became a whole sermon. It wasn't just a simple answer. It was a whole lesson on Judaism. Rav Acha of Shavcha, as we said, was not formally a Gaon. He should have been. But we see on top of page 8, the letter of Shrira Gaon explains the history. Why is it that he was not a Gaon? And he goes on and says, after him, this is one generation after the next, Rav Natroi Kahana ben Marav Amuna reigned as the Gaon, as the head of the yeshiva. He was from Baghdad, from the outer bridge. In other words, it was an area that was well known. In his days, Rav Acha of Shavcha went up to the land of Israel. This was because Rav Natroi had been a close student of his. And when the Reish Galusa, he was a grandson of Bustanoi, this is, appointed his student over himself, as the master, because he did not like, the Reish Galusa did not like Rav Acha, and therefore appointed his understudy as the head. But he felt he had no place. He left and went up to the land of Israel. I'd like to go, but he should have been the Gaon. It takes a very interesting form, which is itself, it's important to, it's such a classic, the She'iltas, it's worthwhile to go over what is the form of the She'iltas. And I've taken two samplings of the She'iltas. One is, it begins on page 9. We can go through this together. She'ilta is a question. So She'iltos is questions. These are the answers to the question. And it starts off, this is the question. The house of Israel is required to rest on the day of Shabbos. It starts off with the beginning is there's a prologue to the question. This question is section 2. As you see, there's 1, 2, 3, 4. A full She'ilta would have these four sections, even though most of them only have 3 or 2. It says, the house of Israel is required to rest on the day of Shabbos. This is the prologue. And here, someone reading this gets to know, who hadn't studied through the Talmud, would know an awful lot about Shabbos. For when the Holy One, blessed be He, created the world, He created in 6 days, and rested on the day of Shabbos. He blessed it and sanctified it. This is similar to a person who built a house. When he finally erects it and puts the finishing touches to the house, he makes one day celebration. It's a Chanukah Habayis. Shabbos is the celebration of the creation of the world. This is the popular saying, Hilul Sizbote, or Kilul Bote, is the celebrating of the building of a house, that is, as is written, Vayachal Elohim, This is on the seventh day. Raphael is, this is the celebration. And the Merciful One told us, rest on the seventh, on the day of Shabbos, just as I rested. As it is written, remember the day of Shabbos to sanctify it. And this is how he starts the first part of this. So he begins with an introduction, is Shabbos is a day of rest, Shabbos is a day of celebration. Right? He clearly says that the purpose of the Shabbos is the celebration of the creation. And he goes on to the next part now. It's forbidden to afflict oneself, to fast on that day. Rather, a Jew should enjoy himself on that day. This prohibition applies when one makes a vow to optionally fast. Because if you made a vow, you can't make a vow to fast on Shabbos. However, if he saw something disturbing and wishes to fast in order to annul the terrible dream, a tainus chaloim, this is allowed. The person has this terrible prophetic dream. He is allowed to fast on Shabbos. And he doesn't, and he quotes from a passage in the Talmud, in Shabbos, in Yud Aleph Amud Aleph, says in 11a, for Rav ben Machasya said, in the name of Rav Chama ben Gurya, in the name of Rav, fasting is as potent against the dream as fire against shredded flax. Said Rav Yosef, providing is on that very day, and Rav Chisda added, even on the day of Shabbos. This is the prologue. Basically, he says, Shabbos is not only a day of rest, it's celebration, and the only exception is if one had a disturbing dream. So, however, the following, tzorach, it's a Baram Tzorach At L'melech. However, you have to do research into the following. So, yeah, the prologue now is the question. If a person is fasting on Friday, can he complete the fast on Friday or must eat before nightfall? Now, this is because if you're fasting all day, you don't make Kiddush immediately. It's 1 minute or 5 minutes or half hour, an hour into Shabbos. So it comes out that you really started Shabbos fasting. And this is part of the fasting of the previous day. Is that allowed? And really, this is a quote from this is really a question which is in the Talmud, and the answer is in the Talmud. It was not the purpose. As you said, the shilt is not so much to create new ideas, but really it seems to be a popular work for the masses to make them familiar with the basic teachings of the Talmud. This is directed for non-Talmudists, so to speak. You know, people who are not part of the yeshivas, have not gone through Shas, but who want to be the literate. And additionally, and he asks another question, is one allowed to take large steps to run on Shabbos in order to hear a class in Halacha or attend a Talmudic lecture to pray? Which is we take from the Gemara and Brachas and Vav Amud Beis. That's the second section. So the first section is a prologue. Second section, after he told you about not to fast, what about this thing? Before he gives the answer, again, he fills you with a lot of information. That's section three. You know, before I give you the answer, that reminds me of something. And he goes on again as a sermon to give a wealth of information. And he starts off here, starts with a blessing that he gave us Torah, and he says, our rabbis taught the plates on which one eats on the evening may be washed in order to eat on them in the morning. Washed in the morning, maybe washed in the midday. Those at midday are washed in order to eat at mincha. But from mincha and onwards, they may no longer be washed. Can't use them. So therefore, if you're not going to use them on Shabbos, just put them aside, and you'll wash them after Shabbos. As to goblets, drink ladles, and flasks, which you may continue, when you continue washing them all day, because even after you finish the meal in the afternoon, assuming there's still more time of day, you still drink. They didn't have the late shalashutas like we had, I guess. There's no fixed time for drinking. And it goes on again to quote about the importance of three meals on Shabbos. He's before he gives the answer, he gives them a lot of information. And now finally, regarding the question you asked, and then he goes on to give the answer. We find, there's another quote here, again, to give you a sense, the style, is again on page 10. This was actually the very first Shilta, the first one I quoted, the beginning. This is taken from, this is on Parshas Lech Lecha, the first is Parshas Bereishis, so Shabbos is Bereishis. This is Parshas Lech Lecha. The Jewish people are required to study Torah, to teach it and to know the texts. Any person who influences his friend to go on to study is considered as if he created him. So he begins with the importance of the study and teaching of Torah. And he goes on to say the importance, again quoting liberally from the Talmud, about the importance of what it means to touch somebody, to teach somebody. The effect is you're considered as if you're a parent of that person. However, again, that's the prologue. Section 2 is, however, one needs to know the following. Which one takes precedence, the study of Torah's fulfillment? I have a question, what to do? Should I study? Or should I do a mitzvah? What should I do first? What do I do? At this moment, I can't do both things. So what should I do? And he comes 3, he comes in again. This is really a quote from a Gemara in Kedusha, 40b. And really the answer is, for the most part, is if somebody else, he doesn't say, he's just quoting from that thing, but the halacha is, if someone else can do it, if it's a mitzvah that someone else can do, you remain studying and let the other person do the mitzvah. If there's no one else to do it, of course, you stop your studies and do the mitzvah. But this is all taken from the Gemara and Kedushin, the third part. He comes straight out in the answer. He doesn't have an introduction like he had in the previous one. Here he comes straight out with the answer. And again, it's a question of scholars. Is this how it was originally composed, or perhaps it was shortened? The style, though, I just want to point out before we go on to the next section, the style was not created by Rav Acha. It's a very old style of how they used to give drushes, how they used to answer questions and give drushes in antiquity. One is from the Talmud itself. We quote on page 11. I'm not going to quote. You can read this through in its entirety. There was a question asked, a clear-cut halachic question: can you extinguish a burning lamp for a sick man on the Shabbos? From page 11. The one who answers with Tanchum says, gives the answer, and he says he does not give it directly. He speaks about, he goes on to discuss the whole story about the precedence of life. He says, David HaMelech said, Lo yameisim yahalu ko. He says, the dead can't praise you. Evidently, it's better to be alive. King Shlomo HaMelech says in one passage, he says, Shabeach ani es ameisim shekvar mesu in Koheles. I praise the dead who have already died. It seems it's better to be dead than alive. And he goes on to another passage, though, Solomon in Koheles, and he says, Ki lekelev chai hu tov min arei emes. Arei emes is a dog that's alive is better than even a lion that is dead. So what is it? Is it better to be a dead or alive? And he goes on to expound on this, that while you're alive, you're able to do mitzvah, so in that sense, it's better to be alive. However, the dead have tremendous influence over the living. And it goes on to explain that when Moses wanted the Jews to be forgiven, all his prayers were not effective until he said, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, for their sake. So the dead have schusim, have merit, that the living don't. And it goes on, it's a very long passage in Agadah of the Talmud. It's a fascinating story how David himself, David HaMelech, died. And it finally at the end, he says, you know, and by the way, regarding the question that you asked, and he doesn't answer it straight out either halachically, which of course is to say a human life takes precedence. This is beautiful, again, in the Agadic style. He says, a lamp is designated a lamp, and the soul of a man is called a lamp. You know, the better is the lamp of flesh and blood be extinguished before the lamp of the Holy One, blessed be He. A neshama is called nishmas. Says ner elokim nishmas adam. Says the soul of a man is called the lamp of God. Well, God's lamp takes precedence over a human lamp. Again, a very poetic way of expressing, which is the halacha. But the idea of this combination of the Agarata, these sermons, this poetry, together with the halacha, seems to have been commonplace. In fact, this idea of this order of the question, this prologue, is also, we find, from other sources. And again, we takes us back to the account of Nosson HaBavli. Nosson HaBavli, describing the lecture of the Reish Galusa, and this is by when he was coronated. He begins to lecture and expounds on a subject related to the parsha of that day. Or he gives permission to the Rosh Yeshiva of Surah to begin to lecture. So again, there's a prologue, a lecture about the parsha. Again, having some, it seems similar when we find to the Shilta, where they find something somehow related to the parsha. And as he finishes the lecture, he begins to ask an halachic question. Evidently, before it was not halachic; it was Drush, it was Agadata, and says, "However, you have to do research into the following." And then one of the wise and experienced scholars then gets up and responds appropriately, then sits down. So evidently this seems to have been a common form of how Torah was disseminated in antiquity. But this is the Shi'iltas. But as we see, it's a popular work. I mean, a Talmudic scholar would know all these passages of the Talmud already. In fact, here we have on page 12, and I'm quoting from the Meiri, or Nachum Meiri, who was one of the great scholars in Provence in the 13th century. "We've received a reliable tradition regarding Rav Acha of blessed memory that he had a son who had no desire to dedicate himself to the study of Torah." This is on page 12. "He therefore created his work, the Shi'iltas, in order that his son read it every Shabbos, so that when the Parsha should be read in the synagogue, this work would be used by him to clarify many of the familiar laws of the Talmud." In any case, it was basically meant for people who were not students of the Talmud. And it was a very popular work, which is quoted to this day. Tosfos quotes this all the time, the Shi'iltas. No, this is Rav Acha of Shaphan, who created the Shi'iltas. And he was not a Gaon, as we said, because he was not given that position, because he was not on good terms with the Reish Galusa, the exilarch from the house of David, who had inordinate power then over the appointments of the Rosh Yeshivas. Which takes us now finally to the, again, we're going, this is a series which is going to last a year. And we are going to discuss many works. These are what we call the major works of the period. And this is the Halachos Gedolos. We are familiar with many halachic works. The halachic work that we're most familiar, of course, is the Shulchan Aruch. It was preceded, the Shulchan Aruch, by the Tur in the 14th century, which in turn was preceded by other works. The Tur's father, the Rav Yaakov ben Oshir, says Rabbeinu Oshir, says the Rosh, was preceded by the Rambam, was preceded by the Rif, Rav Yitzchak Alfasi. But the very first, we say, halachic work, which was gained much fame and again was popularly studied, was this Halachos Gedolos. And it is written similar with the Rabbeinu Alfasi, that it goes through, it quotes literally through passages of the Talmud, and to go through every subject, and it keeps on quoting the pertinent passages of the Talmud. So it is a wealth of information of Talmudic texts, because very often his texts may be different than the texts we have. It is a wealth of Talmudic commentary, because the way he brings this down, see, he studied it in certain ways. It is widely quoted, this Halachos Gedolos. And it actually, it is a work which was made of several works. It's really a compendium. The author of this Halachos Gedolos, as we're going to see, was Rav Shimon Kaira. When he lived, we're just going to hold that towards the end of the lecture. Rav Shimon Kaira used the Shi'iltas, used other halachic works, and he used the Halachos Pesukos, a previous halachic work composed by Rav Yehudoi Goin. Rav Yehudoi Goin, if you have a list of the three or four or five or six of the great Gaon, he will be on every list, this Rav Yehudoi Goin. And he was a Gaon from between the year 759 and the year 763, he reigned for 3.5 years. And this Rav Shloimeh Bar Chisdoi, the one who forced Rav Achoy not to take the position, actually forced him to go to Israel, was the one who also prevailed on Rav Yehudoi Goin when there was a vacancy. Rav Yehudoi Goin was from the yeshiva Pumpadisa. We said there were two yeshivas. In the north was Pumpadisa, and the south was Sura. There was a vacancy in Sura. There was no one of his stature, Rav Yehudoi's stature of Sura, to take the position. He felt the yeshiva, with such a history, needs the greatest of the generation, prevailed on Rav Yehudoi, who was not from that yeshiva, to come down and take the position of Rosh Yeshiva. It was in a certain, there was a, Rav Shura Goin quotes that there was another situation that happened some years before, but it was an anomaly. Generally, the yeshivas had their own family, so to speak, who were connected with the yeshiva that went back hundreds of years, and they took from their own ranks. So it was an anomaly, so that, of taking from someone outside the system. I'd like to, who was this Rav Yehudoi Goin? In the Cairo Geniza, which we discussed before, there was discovered a work by a Talmud Chacham by the name of Pirkoi ben Boboi, and he was a disciple of a disciple of Yehudoi Goin. And we'll just to see on page 12 here. From his time until the present, there has been no one like him. He was outstanding in scripture, Mishnah, Talmud, Midrash, Shefta. This is Agadat HaGodos and practical halacha. He never said anything that he hadn't heard from his master. In other words, it wasn't so much that because of his brilliance he created, but because of his brilliance he was able to preserve. So Rav Yehudoi, of blessed memory, says, I have never replied to questions posed to me unless I had proof from the Talmud. I have learned practical laws from my master. My master learned it from his master before him. He was a giant of holiness, purity, piety, and humility. He was careful in observance of every single commandment. He gave himself over to heaven, and he brought humankind closer to Torah and mitzvahs. On his passing, he left no one of his stature to replace him. And what's unusual about of his appointment was at the time he was appointed, he was already blind. And yet, he was appointed, if there was no one like him, and he was appointed. And of course, he was looked at in subsequent generations as someone that one really would not, who was afforded the greatest respect. I'm just here on page 12, so on the bottom paragraph, from a later Gaon, he says, we cannot do that which Mar Yehudoi did not. As a precedent, it would be very difficult to disagree with him. His students collected his rulings, and it was a work called Halachas Pesukos. It was the authoritative rulings. It's from that work, Halachas Pesukos, and again the Shiltas and other works from Shimon Kaira composed the Halachas Gedolos, this great work of Halacha. There's a question when he lived. We only have one source that dates him. This is the Sefer Kabbalah of the Ravid. The Ravid, Avram ben Daud, who lived in the 12th century, quotes that he really lived, he was a contemporary of Rav Yehudoi Goin. He wrote it in the lifetime of Rav Yehudoi Goin. And it seems really in the lifetime of the author of the Shiltas as well. He has a problem, though, in his dating, because he quotes often from a scholar called Kohen Tzedek. The only Kohen Tzedek that we know in history was someone who lived in the middle of the 9th century, not the 8th century. And it's for this reason that many scholars maintain that there was an error, at least from the original source that the Sefer Kabbalah Avram ben Daud took from, and actually he lived much later. Tosfos, so those who learn Daf Yomi, is in the there's a Tosfos in Psochen in Mem Vov Amud Aleph from 46a that quotes from the Halachas Gedolos, that quotes from who cites a ruling in the name of Rav Kohen Tzedek, the Rosh Yeshiva of Moshe Machasya, the Rosh Yeshiva of Sura, this is the one who lived in the middle of the 9th century. And therefore, at least according to Tosvos, I mean, who quotes from this, assuming this is the original edition of the Halachos Gedolos and not a later addition to this, that would be a proof that actually it was not like Rav Ron ben Daud, but actually it was composed much later, which makes a lot more sense that only a person living 100 years later would be able to cull all these earlier sources which have long been accepted. I mean, the Shiltas may have written this, Rav Achoy written for his son, but probably naturally it takes years for a work to be widely accepted. And especially he himself was not a Gaon. You know, so to take that authority, it would be like generations later would look at it with greater authority than those of the present generation. But be it may, it seems that it was really written, Shimon Kairu was written much later. I'd like just to show you just, again, this is very briefly here. We find, again, that Rav Shimon Kairu himself is, even though Rav Yehudoi is looked upon with the greatest respect, the same is not the same of Rav Shimon Kairu. And when they find fault, they say they quote that really they look at him as really as an inferior scholar. I mean, he was basically a collector rather than. And we find this from a Tshuva of Haigon who criticizes him. One of the sources that they quote that he was actually, again, lived in a later time, was that he quotes from Mar Rav Chanina Gaon. It was in two places, in the Halachos Gittin and Hilchos Bechoros. We know. We don't have much record of Rav Chanina Gaon. I mean, there were several perhaps candidates, but the one that is quoted, that we find quoted, is the one who was a Talmud, who was a disciple of Rav Yehudoi Gaon, who lived, of course, in the next generation. And that here on page 14, at the end of paragraph G, is that we have in our possession a halachic ruling of Mar Rav Chanina Kahana Bar Huna Reish Masifta, just the same way of Rav Chanina Reish Masifta, a disciple of Rav Yehudoi of blessed memory. It seems that this person that's widely quoted, and scholars seem that it's really the same person, therefore it's a person who lived after Rav Yehudoi Gaon, which would make it difficult the dating of, this is the derived in the Sefer Kabbalah, that he was a contemporary of Yehudoi Gaon. If you're a contemporary, don't quote the next generation. Furthermore, in one area we find that he quotes Rav Yehudoi and calls him Gaon, Rav Yehudoi Gaon. According to Rav Avraham ben Daud, he wrote this before he was a Gaon. He got the official position. I mean, there are several areas that seem to point that it was really a later, that he lived at a later time. But whatever. Again, you could look at the various quotations, but the Halachos Gedolos itself was a major source of halacha, widely quoted until the Rabbeinu Alfasi, who lived in the middle of the 11th century. It was the halachic work, because this was the work that was most quoted, this Halachos Gedolos, and even all the really, all subsequent works always refer to the Halachos Gedolos. I would just, to end this, I would just like to quote from two minor halachic works. There are several minor halachic works, but just to give you a sense of what was existing. One is a work about tefillin called Shimusha Rabba. It is quoted by Tosfos, as we have on page 16. He is the one, it's interesting. He is the source where we know, at least in written, that on a tefillin, on the right side it's three prongs, and left side it's four. That's from Shemusha Rabba. The tefillin should be wide at least two finger widths. If it's wider, if it's fine, it's less, it's not invalidated, but it's preferred to be two finger width. This is all from Shemusha Rabba. What Rabba is, who is the Rabba? Does it mean great teachings? I mean, it's not clear. there is a case to be made, and this the Rush said, that Rabbah is referring to his teacher. But who was this Rabbah? Because it's not the Rabbah of the Talmud. And scholars quote again, we found in the Geniza in Cairo, again this from Pirkei ben Baboy, which we quoted before, as we said, he was a disciple of a disciple, this Pirkei ben Baboy, of Rabbi Yehudoi. Who was his teacher? His name was Rabbah. And it seems Shemushe Rabbah are Rabbah's teachings. Again, we just end off here again with a minor thing, work. Again, quoted, we find Tosfos in Yevamos quotes. It's called Bosar al Gabi Gecholim, meat on coals, which according to the Ma'aril is not referring to anything that he said, but really just meat on coals. You know, just as barbecued meat tastes good. And it's saying that that was the heading of that sefer, because evidently it contained very interesting, you know, pieces of material that was called, really, it was barbecued meat, it was rotisserie. I just like to just to sum up what we've touched in this lecture, and then we'll open the floor to questions. We had a panoramic view of the literature that was created in the Gaonic period. We gave you a sense of what it was like to be in this yeshiva of the Gaonim. The responsa, which was not made by individual Gaonim, but actually it was a collective work. The fact is that the Gaonim preserved the traditions of hundreds of years before. And not only did they write halachic works, they wrote commentaries on the Talmud, which are, again, often quoted. We've quoted here the histories of the work, which are invaluable for a historian, these are major sources of our lectures. The Seder Olam Zuta, which has given us is really the only historic source for the early years of the Reish Galusa and that position in Israel. The Seder Tanoim Bamaroyim, which again gives invaluable history of dating, and plus the guidelines of Halacha, the letter of Rosh Shiragon, which is a panoramic history of the Mishnah and the Talmud, of the Rabbonim Savaroy and the Gaonim. It's an invaluable work. And by the way, it's considered a reliable work. It was a first-rate reliable work because it was written by a Gaon himself, clearly, and he took from the archives of the Gaonim to compile this work. And then we ended off with the two major halachic, most popular halachic works of the period, the She'iltas, which was really a popular work that went on the Sedras, the Halachas Gedolos, which is really a compendium of halacha based on the Talmud. And then we ended off with two minor works, the Shemusha Rabbah, which is on Tefillin, and the Bosar Gabi Gecholim, this meat on the coals, which is, again, there were other minor works, but these were, so we have a sense of what the seminal works that were produced in the period. In subsequent lectures, we're going to speak about the philosophical works that were created. We've spoken already about poetic works that were created. And again, this is the beginning of the whole series. Okay, now, says, are there any questions? Yeah, the halachas pesukas, right?
The first kind of companion of
the halachas pesukas that preceded it, and after the halachas gedolos, are the first ones that we have. There are other works we're going to there's a Sefer HaMasim, there are works that were composed in Eretz Yisrael which we only have fragments of that seem to be parallel works. But the works that had an impact that we have today are from those works.
So it wasn't a unique motivation for writing down a lot of companion. It's just that
The motivation, of course, for writing this is to make all this work accessible. and is well ordered. And that same motivation that motivated to write the Halachos Pesukos and later the Halachos Gedolos, it seems in Eretz Yisrael there was a parallel work as well. But it was, again, it was the same motivation, as really is to have all the halachas that one could easily access with practical Jewish law. It was all practical Jewish law.
If you're thinking of parallel, I guess my question is, what was the motivation for doing that at that period of time, not 300 years prior or 600 years prior?
I think, and I'm not, you know, the question is, what was the motivation making it now, you know, versus before? We're not sure when the Mishnah was written. We're not sure when the Talmud was written. But even after the Mishnah and Talmud were written in the yeshivas of Babylon, it seems they still study them by heart. I mean, they've referred back to a text, but it was like the goal was to know it by heart. Writing down was something that was not preferred, because ultimately this is Torah Shabbat Peh, the oral law, and one only writes because you has no other choice. It could very well be, and we don't know, that scholars may have in their own minds or orally have presented to their students the halachas in a form that would be more accessible, perhaps, but they didn't write them down. We find only now, in the, like, probably in the year 750 or so, you know, some 300 years after the period of the Talmud, that already the need, this also has to be written down. So it could very well be the reason we don't have it is because it still retained its oral form. And again, only after the generations passed, they felt it can't be preserved anymore this way, that they actually wrote all of these rulings down in an orderly manner and then distributed these manuscripts.
The period of the Gaon is 589 to 1038. I assume the 589 is because that's when the Gemara was stopped. So you start with the period. What was the reason for 1038? There was Gaon and after that too.
So the question is about why the beginning date, why the end date. It's considered generally the period of the Rabbonin Savaroi, as those the immediate students of the last of the teachers of the Talmud, and their students really came to an end. As no one had a recollection already of that generation. They had gone through a very difficult period. We'd alluded to this revolt of this Marzutra of the Exilarch, these Zoroastrian authorities also were very harsh against the observance of Judaism. All of these factors together made Torah study very difficult. And the end of that period Torah was really studied clandestinely in a very much reduced form. 589 begins the reemergence of Pumpadis as a major yeshiva. The political climate has changed, and at that point now the rabbis don't have connections anymore to those who've been part of that, you know, the Talmudic period, and that's why they call themselves, they're no longer part of that process. And it's quite possible, as Rav Isaac Halevi maintains, that it was in that period, right before that period, because of the disruption, the Talmud was written down. So at this point already they have a text in front of them. At the end of the period, Torah was growing all over the world. In Spain, as in the time of Rav Haigon, before Rav Shmira Gaon, and this is a subject of a lecture we're going to discuss in the future. There were yeshivas all over, and in fact, because there were yeshivas all over, it was very difficult for Rav Haigon to continue to get questions sent him through across the world. He had to plead his cause and to get financial support. It was only because of the person of Haigon seems to have been one of the greatest of all the Gaonim, and the people looked at him as head and shoulders above above them, that they acceded to write questions to him, to send students to him. But once he died, those who followed him, they were no greater than the ones who headed yeshivas in North Africa and Egypt and Spain and Germany. So people stop and say, why do we have to send to them? We have our own. And it's where that's why it came to an end.
In this period, the 8th and 9th century, were the heads of yeshivas in Israel also known as Gaonim?
So we're going to discuss that. That is really something, that is a discussion of a later lecture. We do find, though, at least in the 11th century, at the time of Rav Hai Gaon and Rav Shura Gaon, they were called Gaonim. And this was part of the process that they felt we are more or less equals, which was, again, the cause of concern why eventually, that after the death of Rav Hai Gaon, it no longer had that central place, because other places were vying, Israel was vying, and they called their Rosh Yeshivas Gaonim. But I don't know about the 8th and 9th century. We have very little records of the 8th and 9th century. But we do have of the 10th and 11th century. Yeah, oh yeah. The question is who edited, what was in the collections was out of the collection. It seems, and it's important really to understand this, the questions of course were a means of guiding all of Israel, but there was a mutual relationship because the communities supported the yeshivas in Babylon. I am sure every single question that was given to them was answered. Because if it wouldn't be, I'm sure that it would have created a certain dissonance, a strain of relations. And all the answers were sent. A later scholar, though, looking at all of this, that's push it. I don't have to include this or that. And probably what constituted what was put into individual collections or not was the editorial license of a later scholar looking through all this material and deciding that this is worthy of inclusion and something is not. Now that it's just brought up, it's just interesting to note, how is it that Cairo, this in Fustat, was able to collect all these responsa? And why this? When they were asked, the yeshivas of Babylon were asked from all these communities, how it came, there were distribution points. Because they sent money as well. And they had an agent in Cairo. So tshuvas that came, questions, shailas that came from Spain or from North Africa, eventually landed in Cairo, where they were sent, where someone who was going, you have to wait for the right ship or the right traveler, and they were sent to Babylon. Babylon now sent it back to Cairo. The people in Cairo copied them over to make sure to preserve them, and then sent them on. So what we have in Cairo is the preservation of the copy of those responsa, because the originals were then sent on to the various communities. And that's why, because this was the seat of the agent of the Gaonim, that's why they were able to have all these responsa. Again, responsa that would have been sent to Persia, points east of Babylon, would not have been preserved. It's only ones that were sent to points west. So really all you have is from the Cairo Genizim, the responsa, or as a preservation of those responsa that were really sent through their office. And they had a person of great prestige, but they had someone who took care and made sure that everything went to them and was sent back.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.